Hi everyone, welcome to the Intersections podcast, where we discuss how race, religion, and gender are connected to media and communications policy. My name is Faye Daimi, and I'm your host for this episode. I'm a research assistant at the Communications Governance Observatory Project and a first-year PhD student in Communications, New Media, and Cultural Studies at McMaster University.
In this episode, I had an interesting conversation with Dr. Lindsay Bearden, professor in Communication Studies and Media Arts at McMaster University. Her research focuses on racial politics of communication, social justice, and how memories and metaphors of slavery and abolition are mobilized in contemporary social movements. In our conversation, we discussed her article titled "Towards Sick Futurity, Wisdom of Liberation," which challenges ableist health narratives by reframing chronic illness as a source of collective wisdom rather than a burden. The article envisions a future where sick and disabled people play a central role in shaping more just, independent ways of living.
Hi everyone! Today I'm hosting Dr. Lindsay Bearden, and we are going to talk about one of their late articles called "Towards Sick Futurity: Wisdom for Liberation." Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you so much for being here. And today is our first in-person interview, so I hope the quality of the podcast is good enough. Finger crossed. Thank you, Lindsay, to be here. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and let us a little bit know about you.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really happy to be here. So I'm Lindsay Bearden. I teach in the Communication Studies and Media Arts program. My research is about the memory of slavery and how it is kind of reproduced in social movements. So I really think a lot about racial discourses, and I think about how the kind of racial politics of communication, both as a field and as like a set of practices.
Thank you. So I'm going to start with my first question. In your work, how do you see the use of technology as a mechanism for state surveillance? What are the racialized implications of this technology?
Thank you so much for the question. Yeah, so I kind of come to critical technology studies in a maybe somewhat roundabout way, but also how I come to all of my projects, which is primarily through community organizing and social movements work. And so I got into thinking about how discourses of technology are used and have been used since like the Enlightenment era to cover up racism, essentially. And so when I first started studying communication in grad school, like in the 2010s, there was a lot of excitement around surveillance studies. And I was thinking a lot about how there's a much longer history of surveillance, if we're thinking about racialized populations, than just the kind of new fears around new technologies creating ubiquitous surveillance of the general public. At that time, in like 2012, 2013, surveillance studies, as it happens in communication, wasn't really thinking a lot about race, specifically, like how race is built into discourses and practices of surveillance historically. And at this point, I was in the U.S. context, since as well I do American studies. So I kind of come to thinking about technology and surveillance through three different projects. So the first project is thinking about the role that police body cameras played in the first iteration of Black Lives Matter in 2014-2015. So around that time there was a lot of hope that bystander video, people, citizens, like videotaping the police, would help reduce police brutality and would help reduce the number of incidents of police killing black people in the United States. At this time, there was also a real, so much video mediated representations of police killings of black people. It was almost like they were constantly in the news, constantly in the media environment. And so I was a little surprised that there was so much hope about the possibility of technology of kind of counter surveilling the police, because I also lived through the Rodney King incidents with the police, where there was video footage, earlier video footage of police brutality, and it didn't do anything in the trial. And so I was thinking critically about, why do we desire so much for technology to be the solution to racism, and why is it never? And so I started thinking about, like, that kind of took me on this long winding path into how technology has always been kind of built into discourses of race and racial difference and racial superiority. So thinking about way back in the day, how science was used to prove that there were races, that there were racial difference, that racial difference was biological and then later cultural. All of these things have been proven and justified through discourses of science. And pretty similar to that, like, technology, also a form of the discourse of science, is usually comes in to be the savior. Like, technology is going to prevent bias from existing. Like, technology is a neutral thing that isn't a racist human, and therefore is going to produce a more neutral or more fair or less racist society. And of course we know that that's not true, because technologies are made by humans and they're used by humans. And so technology is just, it's neither good nor bad, right? It's just a thing that is used in pursuit of whatever a society decides its kind of goals, aspirations, whatever are. So I really worry a lot about the techno-utopian discourses around technology as it relates to ending racism or ending racial violence. And one of the things that came up in that same period was, as I was bringing up these critiques about, like, you know, you can't think about surveillance without thinking about the history of slave patrols, or you can't think about surveillance without thinking about the history of biometric tracking of people who live in public housing, for instance. And so as I was kind of constantly bringing those points to bear in classes and stuff like that, I would get told, like, oh, you're so negative. Like, what about technology for good? What about surveillance for good? And one of the things that really stuck with me was this kind of refrain that I always heard whenever I would talk about these negative implications, that there was, surveillance could be used to help sick people. That surveillance could be used, surveillance had a good intention, had a good outcome for people who were sick and needed kind of like healthcare related technologies. Well, of course, I actually am one of those people. I wear a medical device. I'm a type 1 diabetic. I am usually connected to at least 2, sometimes 3 devices at any given time. And so I was really interested in this intersection, right? Like, this idea that if you talk about the racial implications of technology and surveillance, then people would suggest, well, okay, there's some bad things, but what about the good things? And that got me started thinking about this idea of, like, the poor sick person who needs technology to make them better and to make them whole, and that actually that is the same Enlightenment discourse, that technology and science is going to perfect the white liberal subject, which is kind of my main theoretical interest. So I, even though I kind of frame my work more as the racial politics of communication more broadly and thinking about social movements, there is a thread of like surveillance studies and critical technology stuff through all of my projects. And my projects are really kind of disparate. So it's fun to get to talk about surveillance specifically in this context, from the early work on police-worn body cameras and the potential negative implications of having footage that is from the perspective of the policeman, to the kind of potential negative implications of all of these medical devices that particularly type 1s wear, that creates all of this data. But the data is owned by the technology companies. It's proprietary software. We don't have access to our own data in a format that is easy without consenting to all of their like privacy releases and allowing them to essentially own the data. And I really worried a lot, especially in that era, about how would the data be used? Would the data be used to suggest that some diabetics were bad, that they were not compliant, that their numbers weren't good, and therefore they would be denied care? And so, you know, all of these things kind of relate to really my kind of one of my main theoretical interests, which is like, why are the things that seem or rather things that I have this tendency of like taking a thing that seems good and telling you why it just continues to reproduce like white supremacy. So I'm not,
Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to move to my next question. But before that, I was thinking about how when you say that, you know, surveillance towards, you know, people with disability or in diabetes, it's good, it is good for you, it's for your own good. It kind of reminded me of how, you know, strict parents or in the religion, they said that if we are, you know, surveilling you, if we are, you know, controlling you, it is for your own good. And it is for your own, you know, it is from, you know, goodwill. And yeah, I don't know if it's related, but it kind of reminded me of that.
Yeah, I mean, it is related. And I think it's related to some of the other points that we've been talking about, because it is this paternalistic orientation towards sick people, like as if sick people aren't fully agentive human beings that have authority over their own bodies to make their own choices. And that's a product of ableist culture, like period. But one of the things that happens specifically with diabetes, which is an interesting aspect for me as a critical race scholar, is because of is the ways that blame and shame around diabetes is treated differently by the type of diabetes you have. So if you have type 1, you're the innocent white middle-class kid who just needs a pump and has an overly aggressive mom who's going to get make sure the health insurance covers it and on, right? And if you are a type 2 diabetic, it's usually figured as a racialized person, whether that's Black, Indigenous, or Latinx, someone who caused their own illness by eating too much, by being lazy, or someone whose parents caused them to be sick. All of these are tropes of the kind of pathological culture. All of these are racist tropes about non-white groups of people. And they all relate to the intersection of technology, ableism, ability, disability, and race, right? Because you can't have the white subject that just needs an easy technological fix like the pump to then be the perfect, be re-brought into the kind of productive member of society. You can't have that figure cannot exist without the racialized other, the foil that suggests that there are groups of people who aren't fully culturally evolved or civilized or have biological deficiencies even. And all of that is kind of blamed on individual actions and behaviors and choices. And type 1s of all races will often get frustrated with discourses around diabetes and say, well, you know, I didn't cause my own illness. And unfortunately, that actually reproduces a type of shame, and it reproduces a type of blame, at least. And so in my work on human trafficking, I think a lot about discourses of blame against Black mothers. And so thinking about in anti-trafficking media imagery, how Black mothers in Africa and the Caribbean are often framed as trafficking their own children. And in the book that I wrote about anti-trafficking campaigns, I trace how those narratives are these kind of long-standing Enlightenment era discourses. And the funny thing to connect it all back to surveillance,
the idea of surveillance about that for care, is like
anti-trafficking, but in its own way. So in anti-trafficking, you probably have been to like an airport and you've seen the signs that are like, you know the signs of human trafficking, and like if you see something, say something and report whatever. So all of those hotlines and those advocacy campaigns, what they're encouraging like everyday people in the airport to do is racially profile people who they think are out of place and then call the police on them. And then these campaigns are framing that as if they are liberating quote-unquote enslaved people or freeing trafficked people from their perpetrators. It's just another iteration of how this idea of we're surveilling you for your own good, or we're putting you in jail to keep you safe, right? We hear that one a lot too, that all of these discourses ultimately are kind of different versions of this kind of original set of discourses, which is essentially the foundation of European liberal humanism that's kind of suggests that that you know individuals have the right to individuals get their freedoms through rights and through property, yada yada. So
thank you so much. You already mentioned about the questions I wanted to ask, but this part is, what is the role of privacy and tech law and policy in this context that you are looking at?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a good one. So this one applies to all of the cases because they all have their own legal regimes attached to them. But in the case of medical devices, I think that might be the more interesting one to think about with privacy, because my experience as a wearer of these technologies is that in order to, so basically the way an insulin pump works is it's programmed to give you a certain amount of insulin every hour, and then you program it when you eat, and so then it gives you more insulin and you kind of control it. But they're also integrated with what are called continuous glucose monitoring systems. And that is like taking your blood sugar like every couple of minutes and sending it to your pump through like a radio signal. And then that, although I think now it's Bluetooth, but and then that data tells your pump what to do differently. So to give you more insulin or to give you less. So to keep your blood sugars more in the appropriate range that someone would have if they had a functioning pancreas. But the doctors love the data, right? Because they get to see, they can make more adjustments. Like, okay, every Tuesday at 10, for whatever reason, your blood sugar goes up. So then it's like, what are you doing at Tuesday at 10? Was it only one Tuesday at 10? Or is it every Tuesday at 10? You sleep in a little later. Or you drink your coffee a little longer. Or like you have class and so you're performing. Or you have class and so you're stressed. Like all of these things affect our blood sugars. It's almost the least is really what you eat, to be honest. It's like everything else that's going on in your body and related to stress and things like that. But in order to get the data off of the machine, you have to upload it to proprietary software. And so in order to use the proprietary software, you have to sign like a million consent forms. The thing about this is when I teach about consent and surveillance and digital technologies in like my undergrad classes, and I ask the students, how would you resolve this problem? Like, what would you do? to make this work better or whatever. One of the answers I always get is like, make the consent form like more clear or easier to read or some magical kind of solution to the consent form. But what really kind of blows their mind is when you think about it in relation to health data, it doesn't really matter if I consent to giving the company my data. I have no other way to get the data. I have essentially no other way to live, right? So what does a consent form mean in that relationship? Like, I'm compelled, I'm literally coerced to say, yes, I consent to this, because my option, if I don't consent, is I don't have access to life-preserving, life-saving technologies that literally keep me alive. Like, I would die within 24 hours, you know? And so it's like, it's really a helpful case study to think through, what does consent mean? What does privacy policy mean? Like, there's no consent form. There is really not even any consent process that I could imagine in this kind of litigation-based system that would actually give me the possibility of withdrawing my consent. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Because I don't necessarily need the data, but I need access to, like, all the stuff that's happening. And so, you know, I've had experiences before where, this was in Cleveland, I was part of, like, a diabetes clinic there, and they decided they were, like, running a trial, and so in order to have my appointment with the doctor, I had to sign a consent form that said I was willing to have all of my data enrolled in this study, that they would be using all of our data, but it would be, like, de-identified, like, it wouldn't affect me directly. Now, I don't really believe that. I don't really believe that that's ever possible. But my option was, I was very uncomfortable with that, and I was especially uncomfortable being coerced into signing it. And I asked the clinic what my options were, and they said, well, you can cancel your appointment. And it was like, well, I had waited 6 months for the appointment, so I'm definitely not canceling the appointment. You know, so these are the types of things that if we really center sick people's experiences, we learn so much more about technology than if we're only worrying about, like, real specific things around privacy and consent, you know? And I think that's kind of what I brought to my initial interest in surveillance studies, which was just more of like a, like, you're worrying about the wrong things, or like you're getting bent out of shape about these, like, smaller debates, and you're kind of missing a bigger picture relationship. What is the relationship between race and technology and the creation of society that we live in?
Awesome. So you described how people with chronic illnesses are blamed or shamed for their conditions. How does this societal attitude shape public health policies, and what are the broader implications for social justice?
Yes. How does blame and shame shape broader public health policies? Unfortunately, so much. I think the idea that sick people are either not fully capable of making their own decisions, or are children, which is another version of that, or don't know what's in their own best interests, like, that's one part of how public health policy directives and things get made around disabled communities in particular. And then the other part that you see around diabetes is, again, primarily targeted at type 2s, but some really, really nasty public health campaigns that are intentionally shaming, and they really are trying to supposedly raise awareness about what causes type 2, but ultimately what they're doing is they're shaming poor people's eating choices, and they're not talking at all about food deserts or lack of fresh access to fresh vegetables, you know, different cultural traditions around types of foods that are cooked. You know, there's this whole, I have a friend who had the diabetes that you get temporarily when you're pregnant. And she's Asian, and we've talked about the Sick Futurity Project a lot together because I want her to be a part of it. And she was just talking about, like, how much racism and stigma she faced. Like, oh, of course you have diabetes because you're Asian and you eat a lot of rice. And that, like, eating rice is the problem. And it's like, I'm pretty sure eating rice isn't the problem, you know? But even if it is the problem, why is it in a register of blame? And on top of that, then a type of real racist shaming, racial racist shaming, right? Around culture. It suggests that there is a universal white subject that eats a certain type of way or could or should, and that everyone should do that. And if you don't, you've created your own illness and sickness. When, of course, I hope as listeners of this podcast, we all know that the real illness and sickness is capitalism and white supremacy, right? That is what creates all of the illness and the sickness that we think of now in the first place. Okay, but what was the original question?
I was asking how does this societal attitude shape public health policies, and what are the broader implications for social justice?
Yeah, so I think in terms of social justice, like, this was one of the things that my collaborator and partner, Cal Bierick, and I were working through in the Sick Futurity Project. That we've done a few pieces, a zine and an article in Semanosphere, and we're hoping to move in to do more interviews, creative arts-based interviews with diabetics in the future. But one of the origins of that project was discourses around pre-existing conditions in, or underlying conditions, I think was the phrase, during COVID. And so, you know, we're in Canada, COVID lockdowns were really intense. We were just like in our small apartment for like, I felt like 2 years straight, you know? And so we were talking a lot about these narratives of underlying conditions, diabetes being one of the ones that in the beginning of the pandemic, everyone would say a lot, like, you know, you're fine unless you have an underlying condition. And it was this sense of like, there was this idea that we were going to help the sickest people. It was framed again in this idea of care towards the sick, but really condescending and paternalistic way that ultimately was based in a narrative of shame, right? That like, you created your own sickness. Now we have to be the heroes to come save you. And that really pissed me off as someone with a chronic illness. Because, like all people who are marginalized in one way or another, the people who are marginalized are the people who know how to navigate and survive this hellhole, right? Like, we are the ones in whatever index it affects you. And so it's a basic point that, like, Black feminists, third world feminists, feminists of color have been making for decades, that, like, you know, the people who are the most directly impacted are the ones who are going to be able to say, this is how we could all survive better, right? That we could all survive better if we trust and listen to the ways that people, like, survive under conditions when it's not affecting the general public. And so I was just in this little sliver of crisis, I just was so enraged around the narratives around diabetics causing their own death through COVID, when amid a massive public health crisis where people weren't getting vaccines, protections weren't being mandated. I mean, in Canada, we did have a lot of mandates, but people still weren't getting access to what they needed. In the US, there weren't a lot of mandates, and so people had to take it into their own hands. And so I think that your question is directly at the heart of the idea of Sick Futurity. Like, if we think about the pandemic from non-sick people's view, which is predominantly how it was being presented, like, all of a sudden everyone was about to be sick and everyone was freaking out. And I just remember being like, if the fear is that you're gonna get sick, like, you can have a fucking fabulous life as a sick person, i.e. me, you know what I mean? Like, like, that shouldn't be, that's not necessarily the problem. It was this massive ableism around, like, oh my God, everyone now was, like, worried that they were going to become the stigmatized figure that they created,
yeah,
right? Or that they benefit from. And then, but the flip of that was, what if we think all this stuff through sick people's experiences, sick people's wisdom? And in that regard, you know, I'm drawing on a long line of disability justice activists and scholars who have theorized this stuff for much, much longer time. And it's just kind of a simple point, you know, like, we could do it this way and it leads to, like, more shame and blame and not good health outcomes. Or we could actually listen to people who navigate pandemics, like, all of the time, and have survived them. And pretty much every sick person I know is fucking fabulous, you know? Because you have to be. It's kind of like being queer. It's like, yeah, like, if the world calls you shit, like, you have to make it good for yourself, right? Like, that's why we're so sparkly and, like, we have so much, like, flair and confidence usually. It's just like, we made these spaces because we were told we were trash, you know? And I think that's just an experience of marginalization that so many people have, even if we don't have the same experiences of marginalization. And it seems frustrating, like, that we still don't get it as a society. Like, how easy would it be to just, like, listen to people who were saying, I already do this, I know the answer? Like, what type of arrogance must you have? You know what I mean? Yeah. To just be like, oh, you're just, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. To invent the wheel again, I guess, for that one. I think that's, you know, bring us to my semi-last question, that how can technologies of surveillance, like police body cameras or wearable health devices, be reimagined as tools for liberation rather than control? How can sick futurity and radical independence as a radical thinking of health and surveillance guide us in this man? I'm so sorry, I have to cut it. For guide us in a dismantling oppressive surveillance system and building more just future.
Yeah, well, for me, it's not the devices, you know. For mm-hmm. me, it's the wisdom that comes from navigating whatever you're given. So in the case of type 1s, my experience with, you know, being a type 1 who has, you know, was diagnosed in 2000, it was like the cutting edge of wearable pumps that were becoming more available, but still not super available. And I've lived through year after year new diabetic technology innovation. Every single time they said, this is the one. This is the one that's going to make it better. This one solves all the previous problems. And every single time they suck and they break and they don't work. And the only reason they work is because me and other sick people and other people who care about sick people make them work through our, Cal would say, tinkerings, or through our relationships of interdependence, how we support and help each other with technology and in spite of it, you know? And so I think the body cams article, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in counter surveillance technology, but what I do talk about a little bit in that article is the more radical liberation possibilities in people in the kind of cop watch model, where it's like, it's actually just organizing. It's people coming together to support people who are being harassed or hurt by the police. And there's a technology element of it, but it comes out of community relationships. It comes out of knowing what to do with that footage, how to become a participatory defense committee for someone who is undergoing trial, for instance. These are all community organizing strategies, just like mutual aid and radical interdependence. These are all relationship based. They're not technology based. Technology is fine. Like, it's fine. It exists. It can be used for good. It can be used for bad. But what underpins all technology use is the relationships that people have that are using it. So even when you had, like, the early excitement around, like, like the Twitter Arab revolutions, right? Like 2011, and it was like, oh my God, Twitter made a revolution. It's like, that's so stupid. Like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, people make a revolution. Twitter might have something to do with how information is shared amongst people. It doesn't mean it isn't important, but it does mean that, like, they're what we're missing when we always are focusing on technology as either the fix or as the problem. We're missing the structural. We're missing both the structures of oppression as well as the interpersonal relationships of care and community building that are the things that ultimately resist those systems, plain and simple. I mean, I'm a community organizer through and through. That's how I come to all of these projects. You're never going to convince me that technology would solve a problem that people can't or haven't already dealt with together. So I think technology is just, it's always changing. It creates different conditions. It's not like everything's always the same. It requires us to really have critical thinking. What is good about this? What's not good about it? What's really going on with it? But all of that is in this backdrop of, you know, a lot of academics and news and corporations constantly replaying this discourse that the technology is going to save us. Now, why would those groups of people want the technology to save us? Because it's in their interest to invisibilize the structures of oppression that we're trying to be saved from in such a way that they continue to profit, right? They're making a product and they're selling it to us as the solution in such a way that they're invisibilizing the actual causes of the problem and making money off of it. It's a perfect fix for them, but it's not helping us get more free. It's not helping us dismantle structural violence. So for me, the answer to how can we reimagine technology is it's always just comes back to people. Like, technology, we can use it, we could not use it, we can find cool ways to deal with it, we can find cool things to do with it, whether that's counter surveillance or, you know, there's a whole group of people who hack their pumps. They like change, they, I don't know how to do it. It's kind of, it blows my mind, in order to not have to use the proprietary software of the corporations. Unfortunately, if you hack your pump, you void your warranty. Oh. And if your pump ever breaks, which they do every year pretty much, you would not be able to get a new one. Oh. So it's like, again, there's all these ways of recouping the resistance, kind of like Alejandro was talking about in today's session. But yeah, I think it's the relationships that we build, and to the extent that technology can support that, you know, I think those experiments are great and wonderful. To the extent that technology, or like a lot of really creative uses of technology that are essentially like performance art, where they can shed light on a critical issue, I think those are wonderful ways to turn technology for good or whatever. And then I think every time there's an epic new change, like we're living through right now with generative AI, it kind of really challenges us to think about what are our core values as a group. So that might be a group of friends, a department, the faculty of the humanities, like university, higher ed, society. Like, instead of just panicking about generative AI, which I have done a fair amount of myself, what does it tell us or change or make more clear about what skills we need to develop? And so one of the ways I'm dealing with it next semester is I've changed several of my learning goals to be about community building. So if really I had to answer this question, like, what is humanities good for? And, you know, I come from the place of knowledge is power, but that has to be made through relationships and community building. And so I totally changed the learning objectives for one of my classes, and I'm making it all about building relationships with each other, because that's something that ChatGPT can't do for you. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, in the revolution, when ChatGPT goes blank and no one has access to information, what we will have access to are the relationships we've built.
So that's the sick futurity you're imagining about.
So for sick futurity, I want sick people to get their rightful place. Like, when I was diagnosed with diabetes in 2000, the doctors told me, you can live a great life until 50. And, you know, I was like 19. So I was like, okay, well, 50 seems kind of old. But I also was like, but I'm pretty sure my parents are 50 and like nowhere near retirement age, right? And so I was like, all of these narratives of like people waiting till retirement to do this, that day I was like, nope, it's all happening now. Like, I'm living for the present. I live every day to the fullest. I am not afraid to speak my mind, as we know in this department. Like, there is only this moment, right? And that's actually true for everyone. Like, no one, healthy or sick, is guaranteed more time, right? But when you're told your life is going to disintegrate really quick after age 40 or whatever, it changes your perspective on being guaranteed a future. And so sick futurity is kind of, that's all part of it. Like, what does the future mean to sick people? What does it mean to have a future where we're all sick? What does the future look like if the future is tomorrow? How do sick people, like, are there sick people in the future? Of course there are. And, like, what if we all lived every day like it was, you know, like there was nothing to wait for? The world would be a different place. Revolutions would be happening. Like, you know, vacations would be happening. Like more glitter would be happening. Like, there, you know, it's just like a real zest for knowing what you want and doing it. And even if you make mistakes or whatever, it's like you can't wait out of fear of being wrong. You just have to move forward. And so I think sick futurity, the idea of the future and what the future could be, it comes from that embodied place of like, oh, I was told there won't be the future you might have thought you had, and I changed how I lived because of it. But as I've grown older and become more well-read and gone to grad school and all that, it's like you realize that all of those ideas of like saving for retirement or, you know, I don't know, whatever people do in retirement, like none of it's guaranteed, you know, like, and it's not as trite as that sounded. It's really quite a powerful way of conceptualizing the world. It's not nihilistic. It means that you have to, like, it's not just like, well, there's no future, so fuck it, I'm gonna get high or something, right? It's like this combination of like, you can't put things off, you have to act now, and it is urgently in your own interest to make the world a better place. Like now, not like, you know, I work with this group, not so much anymore because I'm in Canada, but it's called Southerners on New Ground. It's queer South liberation. And they have a saying, queer liberation in our lifetime. And it really speaks to me in sick futurity because it's like liberation now, like not like, oh, small wins and da, 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 da. It's like, no, like, what if we imagine that we could win now? You know, and the academy and the bureaucracy of universities, like, they always want to slow it down, right? I mean, like, Martin Luther King was talking about this, like, in the early 60s, like, you know, that the idea that, like, justice-based projects, racial justice-based projects, are always moving too fast. People always want to slow them down. Well, who are the people that want to slow them down? Not the ones who are being directly affected by it. The people who are afraid or fear they have something to lose from it. And I think all of this is connected to this kind of simultaneous, like, appreciate the present and don't take it for granted, and being implicated in kind of not having a future means it gives me at least an urgency to fight for a better one.
And I feel like one other, you know, people who wants to slow down the changes and the revolutions are the one who are talking about a bright future, and about you know, the a bright future is coming, you have to just wait for that bright future. So I wanted to ask you about the McMaster's slogan that said, you know, a brighter world. So what do you think about this and about the quote-unquote bright future that it's coming for some people? I don't know.
I think it's impossible to build a better world when you're invested in genocide. Like, there's just no, that just doesn't work. So I think that a brighter world is a wonderful slogan. I think it's a slogan that needs to be used ethically. So if you are interested in building a brighter world, that means you need to listen to the people who are most directly affected. That means you need to be engaged materially in the struggle to destroy, you know, all the structures of oppression that we're caught within, including capitalism, including white supremacy, including, well, definitely including fascism, settler colonialism, and state violence. So I think that the thing I love about McMaster's slogan of the brighter world is it's an open invitation to make the world we want. And I think that we have the power, the skills, and the knowledge to do that together, especially at a university. But like all struggles, it's not about the power, the skills, and the knowledge. It's not about the skills and the knowledge. It's about the political will to do it anyways, right? So we can have power, skills, and knowledge to build the world we want, to say how we're going to come to it, to figure it out in the streets, right? To do all of these things that we stand on the shoulders of people who have been doing this and who have named this for so long. But what we need is the political will. And unfortunately, in a big bureaucratic institution, the political will comes from, like, the leadership or the, like, the politicians. But at the same time, politicians and leadership political will is always responsive to the people. Maybe not in the easiest, nicest, fairest way, but every time the people make a ruckus, the leadership does something about it. Now, how do we build a brighter world? We do it together. Like, we do it in the streets. Like, we do it by understanding the structures that create the conditions that we live in, and then figuring out ways to navigate those, change them, and dismantle them. And that's what a brighter world, that's what will make a brighter world.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. I had goosebumps. I had, you know,
I know,
tears,
I got teary.
Everything. So it was a great interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For today. And if you have any last words that you want to share with our audience, please go ahead.
I think it's important to me that all of us in the university, like in this program, my undergrads, the grad students, my colleagues, that we hold ourselves accountable to understanding the histories that created the present that we live in, and that we really get disciplined in struggle, right? That we understand the stakes. And we don't just sit around thinking, it's not going to happen to me, or this isn't my fight, or only people who have lived experience can be a part of X, Y, or Z thing. Because there's one thing to take the expertise and wisdom of people who have lived experience, and there's another thing to hang them out to dry and say, good luck. Yeah. Right? It's like, no, that's not community organizing either. We need to... The reason that we want people's expertise who are most directly affected by any given thing is because they have clarity and wisdom because they're navigating it, right? It's not because they're the people only allowed to speak on it. And for that, we need each other, right? Like, we all need to feel that our struggles are connected so that we can bring down this whole bigger thing. And there is a place for everyone in that work. If you can see yourself in that work. So if you understand that even most privileged whatever person is still suffering under the system of, like, racial colonial capitalism that the past created, that we all live in regardless of how we got here, if you can see that your liberation, your real true liberation, is bound up in dismantling those systems, then we can work together, right? Because now we're talking about mutual liberation, we're talking about collective liberation, we're talking about understanding different people's experiences, understanding different people's gifts and ways of doing things, and bringing that all together, right? Like, one of the phrases I learned in organizing in Philly that I teach to my students at McMaster is, no one knows everything, but everyone knows something, and together we know a lot, right? So, like, if we can just, even in a department, like, if we can just bring that orientation toward all of the work that we do, we will have a brighter world.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast. I hope you would understand how much privilege you have for listening to this podcast. To this episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Intersections podcast. To learn more about the Intersections and listen to more episodes of this podcast, please visit theintersections.ca. Bye, until our next episode.